Good afternoon. I call the Health and Social Services Committee to order at 3:02 p.m. on Thursday, February 7th in Davis Room 106. And we have a quorum to conduct business. With us is Representative Mina, Representative Ruppridge, Representative McCormick, Representative Fields, Representative Sumner, and Representative Sadler will be joining us in just a moment. And, of course, myself, Chairman Representative Crox. And I'd also like to introduce my committee aide, Riley Nye, who will be helping us out. And returning is our House Recorder, Lori Rowland, and Lisa Denny, our teleconference monitor. And we have two bills to consider today. First, we're going to hear House Bill 17, Contraceptive Coverage, Insurance, Medical Assistance. And then we'll hear House Bill 58, Adult Home Care and Medical Assistance. And I think we need to be done by 4 o'clock this afternoon. So we'll try and limit to a half hour each, and if we can do less, give somebody else more time, that'll even be better. So, with that, I'd like to invite Representative Carey, Legislative Aide Sherry Bowman, to come forward to the table, introduce yourselves for the record, and walk us through House Bill 17.
Good afternoon, members of the House Health and Social Services Committee. It's great to join you today as a representative. I've sat up here at this very table quite a number of times as a staffer, so this is my first bill hearing as a legislator, and I'm happy to join you as the representative for West Fairbanks, House District 35. And thank you all for hearing House Bill 17. So since the mid-1990s, 28 states have required health insurance plans regulated by the state that are providing coverage of prescription drugs and devices to also cover prescription contraceptives. And federal law under a provision of the Affordable Care Act in 2010 expanded on these state policies in several ways. The ACA's contraceptive coverage guarantee stems from Section 2713 of the Public Health Service Act, which requires non-grandfathered health insurance coverage and employer-sponsored group health plans to cover preventative services without cost sharing. So Section 2713 required coverage of women's preventative services as defined by the Health Resources and Services Administration. The HRSA asked what was then the Institute of Medicine to recommend that women's preventative services should be covered. And based on this recommendation, HRSA defined women's preventative services to include all contraceptives approved by the FDA and patient education and counseling for women of reproductive capacity as prescribed by a healthcare provider, collectively referred to as contraceptive services. The final preventative services rules issued required insurers and group health plans to cover all such contraceptive services. More recently, some states have amended and expanded their own requirements to match this federal guarantee. For example, 22 states and the District of Columbia have ensured that women can receive an extended supply of a method at one time. This is usually a 12-month supply rather than the typical 1 or 3 month supply. So what House Bill 17 does is it puts into Alaska statutes language consistent with the standards set in the federal contraceptive coverage guarantee and also mandates coverage for dispensing up to 12 months of prescriptive contraceptives at a time. Alaskans often face numerous challenges when they're trying to access prescription contraceptives. Women, especially in rural areas, often cannot take multiple trips a year to the pharmacy. Additionally, many women work in high-demand careers that take them away from a regular provider, such as working on the North Slope, working in the field doing research over an entire field season, on fishing vessels, in the mining industry, or other professions that make consistent contraceptive access a challenge. A one-year supply of contraceptives can assist many women in balancing personal health with their work and professional careers. Research featured in the Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology in your bill packet shows that women who are dispensed a 12-month supply of contraceptives have a 30% drop in unplanned pregnancy and a 46% drop in the likelihood of abortion compared to women dispensed a 1 to 3 month supply. House Bill 17 can also save money for the state. In reviewing prior versions of this legislation from previous legislative sessions, the former Department of Health and Social Services fiscal note had estimated a $1.35 million savings annually due to a reduction in unplanned pregnancies. And the current bill in front of you today has zero fiscal impact. So I support House Bill 17, and I'm bringing this legislation forward because not only is it often time-consuming and inconvenient to obtain a prescription contraceptive every 3 months, or in some cases every month, but also because I know that improved access to contraceptives means improved health for women and families. Providers are still able to make decisions in consultation with their patients on what type and length of prescription to provide. However, this bill takes insurance coverage away as a barrier to access. And House Bill 17 also has an additional benefit. It can help protect victims of domestic violence. Over the past few years, there's been an increased awareness in Alaska and on the national level of the issue of domestic violence and sexual assault. I believe we even heard Senator Sullivan talk about that today in his address. So we've learned about the issue of reproductive coercion, also known as contraceptive coercion, and that's a form of domestic or interpersonal violence by abusers. There have been advocates in the past and those who have experienced this type of coercion who have explained and shared stories about contraceptive coercion in which abusers dictate when and how contraceptives can or cannot be accessed as a means of gaining power or control. Supported by a strong, long-standing body of evidence, contraceptive services have long been recognized by both government and a wide range of private sector experts as a vital and effective component of preventative and public health care. Contraceptive use helps women avoid unintended pregnancy. It improves birth spacing, which in turn has substantial positive consequences. And this bill can also be beneficial for infants, women, families, and society as a whole. In the past, I want to just let members of the committee know that there had been support letters received for previous versions of this bill from organizations such as the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. We've just received this afternoon an updated letter. The Alaska Public Health Association, we have a resolution pending from them to give to the committee members, and also the League of Women Voters. In conclusion, House Bill 17 makes sense for Alaskan women and families. And at this point, I want to turn it over to my staff to walk through the sectional of the bill. I also want to note that we have Division Director for the Division of Insurance, Lori Wing Heyer, in the room, who's available to answer questions about this insurance bill. Thank you.
Okay, and just if I can interrupt you for a moment, I forgot to mention that Representative Snapp had also joined us at 302. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sherry Bowman, and I am staff to Representative Carrick, and I thank you all for hearing House Bill 17 today. So House Bill 17 puts into Alaska statutes language that is consistent with the standards set in the Federal Contraceptive Coverage Guarantee. House Bill 17 also requires health insurers to, at the request of the consumer and in consultation with a health care provider, cover a 12-month supply of contraceptives at one time, including over-the-counter emergency contraception that was obtained without a prescription, and provide reimbursement to a health care provider or dispensing entity. Section 1 of the bill lays this out. Section 1 also gives healthcare insurers the ability to enact reasonable cost containment measures and prevents an insurer from offsetting the cost of compliance. In subsection E, cost containment is defined as incentivizing the use of generic or lower cost medications or the use of healthcare providers or pharmacies that offer services or prescriptions at a lower rate. The inclusion of this language gives insurers the ability to steer towards generics as a cost containment strategy, a provision that the Department of Administration had previously advocated for as it could substantially reduce their costs in covering a 12-month supply of birth control. However, subsection F states that the covered therapeutically equivalent version of a prescription contraceptive is not available or is considered medically inadvisable by the healthcare provider of the insured, a healthcare insurer shall provide coverage without cost sharing for an alternative therapeutically equivalent version of the prescription contraceptive that is prescribed for the insured. The inclusion of this language establishes that even though insurers will be allowed to steer towards generics, if a particular generic or brand is determined medically inappropriate by the healthcare provider, then the insurer must accommodate the insured. Finally, subsection H includes a religious exemption, so health plans sponsored by certain exempt religious employers are not subject to the requirements of Section 1. Section 2 amends AS 2910-200 by adding a provision applying to home rule municipalities. Section 3 amends AS 2920 by adding a new section clarifying that municipal health care insurance plans that are self-insured are subject to the requirements of Section 1. Section 4 amends AS 3930090, subsection A, which relates to policies of group insurance covering state employees, by adding a new subsection 13 to capture group health insurance policies covering employees of a participating governmental unit. Section 5 amends AS 3930091, which relates to self-insurance and excess loss insurance, by adding language to capture a self-insured group medical plan covering active state employees. Sections 4 and 5 clarify that the requirements of Section 1 apply to active state employees. Section 6 directs the Department of Health to cover the 12-month supply of prescription contraceptives for eligible recipients of medical assistance. The Department of Health must also provide coverage for over-the-counter emergency contraception that was obtained without a prescription. Section 7 directs the Department of Health to amend and submit for federal approval a state plan for medical assistance coverage consistent with Section 6. Section 8 is a conditional effect of Section 6 of the bill, and Section 9 pertains to effective dates. And again, we do have Lori Wingheyer, the Director of Insurance for the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development here for questions. And we would be happy to answer any questions that you may have for us.
Okay. Do we have questions? Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Through the chair, first of all, I just want to express my appreciation to Representative Carrick for pushing this bill forward. I know that this bill has been in the works for a couple of years, and for myself, it seems like it is common sense to expand that insurance coverage if it has zero fiscal cost to the state and will help increase the freedom of individuals to be able to expand their ability to get the prescriptions for contraceptives. I'm curious what the status quo is for the current month span for different types of contraceptives and whether that's in statute or in regulations.
Through the chair to Representative Mina, I think it's typically between a 1 and a 3 month span, depending on probably the patient needs with in consultation with the provider. I'm not sure about limitations on specific contraceptive methods in terms of coverage. I think that a lot of times that is something that takes place between the provider and the patient. However, we can definitely look into that for you and see what kind of differences there are between types of contraceptive methods.
Thank you.
Representative Sather.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Carrick. My question just established kind of a baseline. What are the current limits to the duration of a prescription for any medication?
Yeah, through the chair to Representative Sadler, that is a good question for potentially Director Wingheyer. I am not sure about all the different range of medications out there and their limitations on insurance coverage. So I might suggest that question might be better suited to Director Wingheyer if she can answer it.
Hold it in advance for a little bit.
Okay.
I guess I'll follow up if a different, slightly different through the chair, Representative Carrick. Are there currently any special limits to the duration of contraceptive prescriptions, which is kind of the same question. I think I heard you answer. It kind of depends on what the doctor or a physician or medical services provider thinks. But I'll ask this, are there any limitations in state law that specifically address contraceptive prescription duration?
Through the chair to Representative Sadler, not that I'm aware of.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Prox. Thank you, Representative Carrick, for explaining this piece of legislation to us. I do have a couple of questions. The first one is on the second page of the bill. I think it starts line 5. This is under number 2. It says, reimburse a healthcare provider or dispensing entity for dispensing prescription contraceptives intended to last for a 12-month period for subsequent dispensings of the same prescription contraceptive the insured. And then this line, regardless of whether the insured was enrolled in the healthcare insurance plan at the time of the first dispensing, I'm uncertain as to what that language is intending to do. Is that something you feel comfortable talking or speaking to?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, I may get this wrong, so you may want to ask the question again to Director Ringheyer, but I believe that that would potentially allow an individual who was prescribed 12 months of birth control and it had not been covered previously to, once they are employed and are able to access that coverage, to submit for reimbursement. But I would also suggest that that may be a good question for Director Ringheyer as well.
Okay, thank you. And just a couple more questions, if I may. On the first page, and it's actually repeated again a little bit later in the bill, line 13, regarding emergency contraception, where it says that the insurer may not require a prescription for coverage of the over-the-counter emergency contraception. That is certainly not my experience with coverage of anything. Typically, that does require some sort of authority for you to be taking that. Emergency contraception is available over the counter. Is this, I guess the real world application of this would be, as you said, with the other one, an application for reimbursement? Or would there be an expectation with this section that a person go to a pharmacy or a grocery store, wherever emergency contraception may be located, and expect to get it at no charge up front?
Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge, if I understand the question right, I think what this is referring to is if someone who is employed and has coverage for Plan B goes and accesses Plan B, they can submit for reimbursement later so that they can access that emergency contraceptive when they need it without having to go to a medical provider first, which is a bit of an undue burden on a lot of folks who are seeking that emergency contraception.
Okay, so not an expectation that they would be able to obtain it at no charge initially without a prescription, if I understand that.
Through the chair, I believe that's correct, yes.
Okay. And then last question would be second page again, line 26. So this is in letter E, but line 26 says, cost containment measure does not... and then the phrase I'm wondering about, unreasonably limit choice in access to coverage. In your estimation, what would be an unreasonable limit of someone's choice, or is that defined somewhere in our current statutes?
Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge, I don't believe that's defined elsewhere in statute. Really, this language is in here to ensure that folks are incentivized, I guess, to go for generics as much as possible. It is a cost containment measure, but there may be situations where a provider feels the need to prescribe a non-generic. I have a non-contraceptive example of that from my own personal life, though I don't have any particular examples with contraceptive coverage. We can ask some providers and get back to you on that, but my understanding is this is just a disclaimer, if you will, on the incentive to go for generics as much as possible, and just allowing providers the option, the flexibility to prescribe what they believe is necessary.
And just one additional follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in this section of an insurer could use a cost containment measure, and insurers do, some of those cost containment measures actually require patients to obtain prescriptions from either a mail order service or from some other source that might, in some estimation, particularly for people in Alaska, be an unreasonable limit on their choice. Would you think that a cost containment measure that this bill would prohibit would be mail order services for prescription medications or contraception?
Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge, I'm not sure exactly. That's not a situation that I had thought about previously. I would consider access to be the key goal of this bill. And so if someone was, say, in Fairbanks from a rural community and was prescribed 12 months of birth control and the only available option at that moment in time was a name brand, I would consider it personally an unreasonable limitation to expect that person to wait for a prescription to arrive by mail to Fairbanks when they're likely headed back to their home community. So I'm not sure if that quite addresses the question, but not exactly a scenario I thought about before. So,
yeah, and no, I just wanted to make sure. Sometimes when I read language of potential statutes, when I see words like unreasonably, that means different things to different people, and that maybe is a potential area to look at going forward. And I don't have anything else. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Summers is going to pass. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the Chair, Representative Carrick. When I first heard about this bill, I believe it was presented as not as addressing simply the extension of contraceptive coverage and was not going to touch on emergency contraception. And look, here in Section 1, there it is. So that's a surprise to me. The questions I'm going to be looking to have answered when I come back with more questions is, to what extent does this provide special consideration for contraceptive prescriptions as opposed to other medications? I see some provisions relating to cost containment, to alternative therapies, the extension of this service to people regardless of when they were enrolled. I believe I understand the policy goal you're trying to achieve, but its implementation is a little more complicated and provides a degree of special consideration for this particular kind of prescription more than I thought it might. And I would actually kind of echo some of the questions that Representative Ruffridge said about not unreasonably, that is, reasonably limits choice. Is there such a thing as reasonable limitations of choice in the case of prescriptions for contraceptive? That's my question to you now. I got more later.
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Sadler, just to address a couple of the points you brought up. In discussing this bill previously, I think it's really important to make a distinction here between emergency contraceptives and abortifacients. They're two different things. Emergency contraception is categorically not an abortifacient. So that's one aspect. And then to address your question about reasonable versus unreasonable, I definitely am interested in looking into that more myself. I think that there is certainly potentially area for consideration there. However, in so much as is reasonable, the goal of this legislation is to direct toward generics in order to help with the cost containment. And so that's certainly my intent as well with the language in that section.
And to follow up, since you raised the issue, could you describe simply for the people back home what the difference is between emergency contraceptives and abortifacients, if I'm pronouncing it right?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Sadler, and I can provide you a detailed description of that later as well, and there is some information in your bill packet. Emergency contraception acts before a pregnancy by medical definition has taken place. So Plan B typically acts after a sperm has made contact with an egg, but before that egg has been implanted in the uterine wall, which is considered the time at which pregnancy is established. So that is essentially the main difference in emergency contraception.
And abortifacient applies after the sperm and egg link up and there's been implantation on the uterine wall. Okay, very good. Thank you.
Any other questions? We are. Anything else that you would like to add at this point, Representative Carrick?
I would, to the chair, I would love a chance for Director Wingheyer to just come up and explain the, potentially answer any additional questions you all might have, too.
We have had an emergency thought, I guess, Representative.
My notes here through the chair, Representative Carrick. Any estimations, if you can speak to them or Ms. Wingheyer or anybody else, as to the cost to the state, to private insurers, to any general increase in rates, what's the fiscal impact of this as it would cascade through the system? I'd appreciate knowing that.
Yeah, and I think Director Wingheyer would be a great person to answer those questions. All right.
Okay, we were looking for an excuse to invite Director Wingheyer up because we always enjoy talking with her. So if you would please come forward and put yourself on the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Lori Wingheyer. I'm the Director of the Division of Insurance for the State of Alaska. Thank you for having me here this afternoon.
Representative Sadler, I believe you had insurance-related questions.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Wingheyer, good to see you as well. You probably heard some of my questions. The first one I'll ask, the general question about what would this bill cost the insurance system, those who provide insurance in the state of Alaska, private insurers, what's the impact on rates individuals might pay? Speak to the financial implications of this bill, if you would.
Certainly. Through the chair, Representative Sadler. To give you a definitive, I've got to go back and do some work, but the insurance companies that we've talked to in previous iterations of this bill thought the cost was negligible. The contraceptives would still be covered. Where the difference is in the cost sharing. So the $3 you might pay as an individual to pick up a prescription for a generic drug. So I will confirm that, but your cost sharing is your deductible and your copay. And on prescriptions, usually a deductible does not apply, but there is a copay. Depending on if it's a generic or a brand named a drug, then your copay might differ. And this bill is asking for those to be waived in the dispensing of the birth control.
Goodness. Well, I guess I will ask another question while I got you here. I'll ask the question, is there anything that could be considered a reasonable restriction on availability? I did hear the sponsors say the intent was to allow or to even drive people towards alternatives. There's a couple little clauses in there that say maybe not, so I just want to make sure I understand the parameters of what might bar a physician from prescribing an alternative generic substitution.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler again, I cannot think off the top of my head for a drug, if you will, a birth control contraceptive pill that is on the market today where there would be an unreasonable expectation or an unreasonable limit for it to be dispensed in the state of Alaska. Now, we could see where there's a mail order and that the person is not going to be available. Let's say you're home, you go to your doctor, you get your prescription, they advise mail order, and you're going back up to the slope. And that would be unreasonable that you can't take your medicines with you when you go to the slope. So they would ask for it to be dispensed as it was written without the generic at the pharmacy at that time. That is about the only thing I could come up with where it would be unreasonable not to go with a generic.
Okay. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Ms. Chair, and thank you, Director Wingheyer, for being here today. I wanted to check on this section here about the, what they call cost containment measures. So that was the question I'd asked for the bill sponsor. So correct me if I'm wrong, but Medicaid uses some of these techniques already. So they use step therapy or prior authorization, and there are certain contraception options within the Medicaid system that sometimes have these cost management techniques attached to them. Would this bill, I guess this bill would then override those for Medicaid. And some of them are in place to have cost savings. So would there be a slight increase to cost of Medicaid for this bill in your opinion?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, of all the things we do in the Department of Insurance or Division of Insurance, we don't do Medicaid, and I really can't speak to that, to what it would do. I apologize, but I don't know.
That is quite okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Sumner.
So I'm not sure if this is a better question for you or the sponsor, but are there any strong reasons that we shouldn't apply this to all medications that are non, you know, that don't have an abuse potential or addiction potential? I mean, some medications are certainly life or death, and running out could be even more extreme consequences.
Through the chair, Representative Sumner, that's an interesting thought. I mean, certainly your provider can prescribe a 12-month dose of blood pressure, cholesterol, whatever medication you might need. But then you find out that your insurance plan only prescribes or only pays for 3 months at a time. So if you've got a 12-month prescription, at some point that plan should pay for the 12 months.
Through the chair, is that not the same situation that is attempting to be addressed here?
Through the chair again, Representative Sumner, I think it's exactly what's trying to be addressed here.
Okay.
And I'll just add, through the chair to Representative Sumner, one of the reasons this bill has been brought forward is because there is a substantial population of Alaskan women who are asking for this legislation. And so this bill could potentially be more comprehensive and include other types of medications. But this is in direct response in proportion to the amount of previous testimony in previous legislatures, individuals in rural Alaska who have asked for this, women who work in professions outside of an urban area. And so that's why this bill has been brought forward. And in addition, other states have also worked on this issue. And I think that that's why, if you sense that sort of limitation, it's not my intent to limit other life-saving drugs or other prescription drugs from potentially not being covered for insurance on a 12-month basis, but this is something that is in direct response, both in previous legislatures and currently, to a need that needs to be addressed for Alaskan women.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Ms. Manning-Hire. What is the, speaking from the insurance perspective, what is the justification for requiring, as my colleague said, any three-month limitation? You look at this and think, why not all drugs if there's an easy benefit? Because many men work on the slope as well. Many men work on fishing boats, et cetera. Do physicians want to check up with their patients every so often, every 3 months or so, to make sure that the medications are working or not working, or to adjust them? Is there a therapeutic benefit to that three-month limitation?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't know that I'd call it a therapeutic benefit, but very often physicians will say, I'm going to give you a prescription, and I want you to come back in 90 days. I want to see your blood work again and see if the medicine we have given you is helping you or not. So I don't think it's unheard of that we do go back and have blood work or have labs run again, and then perhaps at that point they give you a longer prescription or they ask you to come back again.
Through the chair.
Quickly, please.
Certainly. I've been on blood pressure medication now for these many years. My cardiologist has never given me more than 3 months. I have to go back every 3 months or so. And I guess, is there a presumption that contraceptive patients have no changes in their physiology or health condition that would justify having the same prescription, you know, once a year?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it's probably above my knowledge level, but I think birth control is not a drug or not a prescription drug that is looked at as heavily as looking at your lab work. It's more to see, is it effective in preventing contraception?
Okay. Right. Seeing no more questions, thank you, Director Wienhire. Thank you, Representative Carrick. And I'm going to set House Bill 17 aside. And at this point, we're going to move forward and hear House Bill 158. So I'd like to invite the Acting Director of Senior and Disability Services, Tony Newman, to come forward to the table, introduce himself for the record, and walk us through the bill, please.
Good afternoon, Chair Prax and members of the committee. My name is Tony Newman, and I'm the Acting Director at the Division of Senior Disability Services in the Alaska Department of Health. It's good to be here, and I'm grateful for the opportunity to present House Bill 58 on behalf of the governor. This bill would add to the array of services available under Alaska's Medicaid home and community-based waiver programs. I know some of you are quite familiar with the Medicaid waivers, but for those of you that aren't, I'd like to give a very quick overview to help set the table for what the bill is trying to accomplish. Alaska's home and community-based waivers are a part of Alaska's Medicaid program that allow people with disabilities and seniors to remain in their homes or assisted living home settings when they could otherwise receive institutional care, such as in a nursing home. Like all Medicaid programs, the waivers are provided through partnership with the federal government, with the feds picking up about 50% of the cost of services and the state picking up the rest. Alaska has 5 waivers aimed at different populations of Alaskans depending on their needs. They are listed here along with the approximate number of people on them. So you can see the waiver that has the most people on it is the Alaskans Living Independently waiver with about 2,200 people on it. Typical example of someone who would be on the Alaskans Independently waiver might be a senior who had a stroke and now has limited use of their arms and legs and has had to move into an assisted living home. A person on the Intellectual and Developmental Disabilities waiver serves about 2,000 people. Might have cerebral palsy or Down syndrome, but who with enough supports is able to stay at home with their parents or in a group home. The idea of the waiver is to not only provide people with more independence and personal choice, but also save the state significant amounts of money that would otherwise need to be spent on more expensive institutional care. So let's say that you are enrolled on a waiver. What does that mean? It means you are eligible to receive an array of services, and the menu of Alaska's services is listed here. Not all these services are available to every waiver. Some people receive just one service. Some people receive many at once. Some of these services are only provided in assisted living homes. Others are provided directly in people's own houses. The one thing that all people on waivers have in common is that they rely on care coordinators to help set up support plans and help the recipients take best advantage of the resources in their communities. We are grateful for our care coordinators and all the people that work to provide these services. These aren't state employees. These are people working for nonprofits, working for themselves, work for businesses out in your communities. What House Bill 58 seeks to do is to provide the people who are on waivers with a new service option called adult home care that would be offered in a new licensed residential setting type, an adult care home. Our vision is that both the service and the setting will have reduced administrative burdens compared with current assisted living home options, but still ensure the care and safety of the individuals that reside in them. So think of someone you know, a neighbor or a longtime friend who has difficulty preparing meals or maintaining adequate nutrition, or is unable to manage daily personal needs such as bathing, dressing, shopping, or cooking. Maybe this is a younger person with a developmental disability, or maybe it's a senior citizen who's known you all your life. They're getting to the point where they probably shouldn't live alone, but there's no assisted living home option nearby that would allow them to stay in the community that they know and love. So imagine that you own a home with a spare bedroom because your kids are grown and gone. You have space that you could offer this neighbor, but maybe you're not able to provide by yourself all the assistance this person needs. The new options described in this bill are meant for your neighbor and for you. Informal arrangements for care like this, of course, have been part of our society for centuries. Under this bill, the support provided will ensure safety and as much independence as possible for the recipient and adequate support for the caregiver. The idea for this bill was first brought to the governor's attention by constituents who were serving as foster parents to children with severe disabilities who were aging out of the foster care system. These constituents found there weren't easy ways for them to continue to offer care to these foster children when they became adults. The only real option available to them was to turn their family home into an assisted living home with all the licensure and other requirements that would have. So in developing a new option for these caregivers, the department realized that a new type of home care setting could potentially be a value beyond those aging out of the foster care system. This bill extends the possibility of adult home care to other individuals with disabilities, including seniors who qualify under the Medicaid Home and Community-Based Waiver Program. As this slide notes, there will be different administrative expectations for adult care homes compared with assisted living homes. There are many things that will need to be worked out if this bill passes.
We will need to work up regulations that cover the kinds of credentials and training that caregivers will need, what space expectations will be for an adult care home, what the rate of payment would be, and more. The division will invite a lot of input from our partners, families, service providers, care coordinators, advocacy groups, and of course, people with disabilities themselves, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, all to determine the details of the service. And the regulations, once drafted, would go through the public comment process that all regulations go through. But what this bill provides is the conceptual framework that we need to get all that started. HB 58 is needed because the lack of care options, the growth of Alaska's senior population, and workforce shortages all require that Alaskans think creatively and provide more options for people to get the care they need while still living as independently as possible, especially in small communities that likely don't have assisted living and other good care options. We are hopeful that adult home care will grow in popularity and ultimately be an attractive alternative, helping make Alaska the best place it can be for neighbors and friends to live and grow older together. That includes my introduction to the bill. I'm happy to walk through a sectional overview of the bill if you'd like, or proceed with questions.
Do we have questions at this point, or can we go into the sectional? Please proceed with the sectional analysis.
Thank you, Chair Prax. Section 1 of House Bill 58, Adult Home Care Services, adds a new section in Alaska Statute 47.07, Medicaid Assistance for Needy Persons, declaring that the state shall pay for adult home care services for an individual at a daily rate set by the department in regulation for individuals on Medicaid who are at least 18, enrolled in a home and community-based waiver under AS 4707-045, if the individual's support plan is approved for adult home care services, and if the person providing the services to the individual holds an adult care home license issued under AS 4732. This section also allows individuals to receive habilitative and rehabilitative care in addition to adult home care services, and directs the department to adopt regulations setting a rate for the service, establish standards for operating an adult care home, and establish a procedure for transitioning an individual from a licensed foster care home to an adult to a licensed adult care home. This section also directs the department to establish a simple and efficient process to allow a foster parent who holds a foster home license issued under 4732 to transition from the foster home license to an adult care home license for purposes of maintaining the placement of and services provided to an individual who is transitioning out of foster care, enrolled in a waiver, and at least 18 years of age. Section 2 amends AS 4732-010 subsection B to add a new entity, adult care homes, that shall be subject to the centralized licensing functions of the department. Section 3 adds a new section, AS 4733, that defines the conditions under which the department may license an adult care home. A person may be licensed to operate such a home for an individual who is at least 18 years of age and enrolled in Medicaid and home community-based waiver services. An adult care home may provide 24-hour oversight and care for up to two adults for compensation or reimbursement under the adult home care service. Allows the department to establish standards and regulation to authorize care for up to three individuals based on unusual circumstances, and defines care as providing for the physical, mental, and social needs of an individual. Section 4 amends AS 4732-900, subsection 2, to add adult care homes to the list of settings that are not defined as assisted living homes. Section 5 amends AS 4732-900 to add a definition of adult care home, meaning a licensed home, not a business site, in which the adult head of household resides and provides 24-hour care on a continuing basis for eligible individuals. Section 6 amends uncodified law, adding a new section that requires the Department of Health to submit for approval by the United States Department of Health and Human Services an amendment to the state medical assistance plan waivers or an 1115 demonstration waiver as necessary to allow eligible individuals to receive adult home care services and other long-term care services that are not duplicative. Section 7 amends uncodified law by adding a new conditional effect notification section, specifying that Section 1 takes effect if the United States Department of Health and Human Services approves amendments to the state plan submitted under Section 6 and requires the Commissioner of Health to notify the reviser of statutes that those amendments were approved, and Section 8 provides for an effective date.
Thank you. And we have questions. Mr. Representative Sumner.
So
I was just curious. I'm no expert on Medicaid, but so my understanding is Medicaid expansion is 90% federal, 10% state match. This would be 50-50. So I'm no expert, but is there any chance that we'd be taking Medicaid expansion folks or people that would potentially be eligible for that and then reclassifying them and increasing the amount of state match that would be required?
Through the chair, Representative Sumner, the services provided under the home and community-based waiver are provided at a 50-50 rate, unlike the Medicaid expansion services. The Medicaid expansion, the individuals who are eligible for our services need to be found Medicaid eligible. That is, they need to be found Medicaid eligible to be eligible for the Medicaid waivers. But for these services, they're provided at a 50-50 rate.
Okay, thank you. Are there other representatives?
Thank you. Through the chair, Tony, CMS knows about this. Is this implementing a federally authorized level of service, or is Alaska organically developing this level by itself?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, Alaska would be developing this service in collaboration with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. Other states do offer similar sorts of services. They all have slightly different flavors, however, so it's challenging to compare them directly. The state of Washington, for instance, has an adult home, a family care service that's similar. Pennsylvania has something similar. Oregon has what's called an adult foster care program. So this is something the feds have seen before. What's unique about this for Alaska is that all of our services right now that are not offered within a home setting require licensure in an assisted living home setting. So this is, I've heard this referred to as stakeholders as assisted living home light. This is a way that that we can unlock the potential that exists in community in homes around the state and communities around the state and allow their own homes to serve and to provide this service.
Representative Sandler.
Another question. This is kind of a how many angels can dance in the head of a pin, but well, I'll get this simple question. How many of the people that would avail themselves of this adult care home service would be foster children aging out versus how many would be elderly? What's the proportion of market you'd be serving?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we in working up a previous version of this bill, which was called adult foster care, we recognized that there are roughly about 50 children who are on a home and community-based waiver who are also in foster care. So of those 50 children, we determined that a handful, five or fewer a year, are graduating from child foster care and into adulthood and remaining on the waiver. So that's the number of youth who would be eligible under that sort of scenario that the bill imagines. As far as seniors who would be eligible, like I noted, there are about 2,200 individuals on the waiver that is most commonly serving seniors, called our Alaskan Living Independently waiver. So it would be a subset of that number, typically.
Okay. Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair, Mr. Newman. I know we talked about this previously, but just hoped you could share with the committee what pays for inspection of these homes to make sure that the care is safe and adequate for residents. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, the fiscal notes for the bill include staff both at the Division of Healthcare Services who oversee residential licensing, and it is their job to accept the applications and provide the enrollment of and cover the licensure of the setting. At the Division of Senior and Disability Services, we certify the service, the adult home care service. And again, we certify, we gather the application information about the individual who wants to provide the service. And then both the Division of Healthcare Services and the Division of Senior and Disability Services monitor. And we expect, we will be monitoring the Division of Healthcare Services in particular, pays visits to these places. So we have fiscal notes that allow for an extra staff to be hired to conduct that work.
Representative Fields.
And do we have, thanks to the chair, do we have some sort of either guarantee or projection on the frequency of such visits, or these annual visits, more frequently, less frequently? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, if with the permission of the chair, I would ask that Bobby Knave, who I believe is on the line and can answer questions on behalf of the Division of Healthcare Services, might be able to answer that question.
Okay. Mr. Nave, did you hear the question?
For the record, Bobby Nave, Program Manager for Residential Licensing Division of Healthcare Services, through the chair to Representative Fields. For licensed assisted living homes, we currently conduct inspections on a biannual basis. So every 2 years, we go out to the facility, conduct inspections to determine they're meeting their statutory and regulatory requirements. We also conduct unannounced investigations as well in regards to concerns that we receive regarding assisted living homes. We probably follow the same exact schedule for these licensed Alaska care homes.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Newsom. If a situation where the foster parents had two foster children, one was 11 years old, one was 17 years old, assuming adult care home became a approved program, if that older foster child aged out and wanted to stay in the house under the adult care home, could that home operate under two licensures, adult care home licensure and foster care home licensure? Would that raise any difficulties?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, that is a situation that arises now in the assisted living home setting and the foster care setting, and I believe Mr. Nave could speak to how he handles that when that sort of situation arises. So, with the permission of the chair, if Bobby Nave could respond.
Yes.
Mr. Nave, did you hear the question?
For the record, Bobby Nave, Program Manager for Residential Licensing. I did. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, we currently have what we call dually licensed homes. So we have homes that are both dually licensed as foster care homes and assisted living homes. We coordinate with the Office of Children's Services to come up with safety plans that both fit our statutory regulatory requirements for these facilities to ensure that both types of population are served safely and effectively.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. And I don't believe that we went through the fiscal note yet. Do we need to do that at this meeting? Mr. Our director?
Mr. Chair, if you would like me to review the fiscal note briefly, I'm happy to do that.
I think we should get that out of the way.
Uh-huh. Fiscal note number one is issued by the residential licensing section of the Division of Healthcare Services. It calls for a staff who would be a health program manager a community care licensing specialist that would onboard the providers in the first years of the program. So one employee and the travel and other services and commodities that would be needed to employ them. And you'll notice that in the out years for that bill, for that fiscal note, a second position is added on the assumption that the service will prove popular and we need more assistance in managing this new setting.
Okay.
Fiscal note number two is from my division, the Division of Senior and Disability Services, and it also is for the hiring of one individual who would be responsible for certifying providers on the service. It would be a health program manager 2 position, and it would come with, like the other position, would come with a 50-50 Medicaid match, federal 50% federal, 50% state funds, and also the fiscal note includes the travel and other commodities and needs that would go with that position.
Okay. Representative Mina.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, first of all, I just wanted to say I'm very excited about digging deep into this legislation. As some people might know, I grew up in assisted living homes. My family ran assisted living homes for 19 years, and I helped them as a teenager with their regulations and trying to work through SDS. So I really appreciate all of the work that you do for the division and the work that Senior Disability Services and Healthcare Services does for assisted living and home and community-based settings. I have just a couple of questions relating to the fiscal note. So on the first fiscal note related to healthcare services and residential licensing, so it looks like there's an anticipation of licensing approximately 40 new providers in the first 2 years. Does that number come from the amount of like adult foster kids that are on OCS that also are on HCBS waivers, or where does that number come from?
Through the chair, Representative Mina, I will see if Mr. Nave can address this question, but I believe the fiscal note was assembled. It's a fair best estimate of the number of people we think we can onboard. We don't have a clear idea on how many providers will be interested in offering this service in the end. So I think that based on the fact that a single community care licensing specialist can have a caseload of 60 to 70 providers under their management, I believe the thinking was that about 40 is the number that they could manage while also standing up a new program at the same time. And maybe Mr. Nave might want to add anything to that.
Mr. Nave, do you have additional comments?
For the record, Bobby Nave, Program Manager for Residential Licensing, through the chair to represent Amina. The number was an estimate of based off of the number of applications we receive on a yearly basis for assisted homes and the percentage that we base our license for two or fewer. Currently, we have 703 assisted homes in the state of Alaska, with only 154 of them being licensed for two or fewer.
Thank you. Follow up? Thank you. Through the chair, one concern that I have is that I want to make sure that these divisions are able to have the capacity to process these licenses and also to ensure that they are processing the Medicaid applications so that administrators who want to start these homes, whether they're assisted living or adult care homes, are able to do so in a proper time. And so I'm curious how many, community care licensing specialists there currently are in the division, and on average, how many, what's their average caseload for providers?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nave would be able to answer that question. And I also note that Sarah Abramchik from the Office of Children's Services, which issues community care licenses for children, might want to also weigh in.
Okay. Mr. Nave?
For the record, Bobby Nave, Program Manager for Residential Licensing, through the chair, Representative Mina. There are currently 11 PCNs for Community Care License Specialist 1s, 2 PCNs for Community Care License Specialist 2, and 1 for myself, a Community Care License Specialist 3. The current average caseload for a Community Care License Specialist 1 is 78 facilities. These include both assisted living homes and residential child care facilities, residential psychiatric treatment centers as well.
Thank you. Are there additional questions? Okay. Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. Just wanted to ask about what might happen if one of these homes is licensed and the owner of the home is the caregiver and the owner of the home becomes, for whatever reason, unable to provide care. Can they then hire a caregiver who is not a live-in caregiver? Let's say it's a parent taking care of a child. How does this bill foresee that transition, that contingency? Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Fields, excellent question. Those are some of the details that we would need to be ironing out through our regulations. The idea here is that it's a living caregiver who's primarily responsible for the care and would be paid a rate that such that they wouldn't be able to hire additional people to assist them. But could they work in concert with another individual to make sure that the individual is always covered if, say, because they have a job or travel? That is something that we are eager to speak with our partners about and make sure is covered for in regulation.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Through the chair, Tony, Mr. Newsom, I have great confidence in the federal government, but I just want to ask the question, is there any risk that once CMS would approve this change to our Medicaid plan, that they might change the terms of the contract? That there's no risk that we might engage and approve this level of service and see funding withdrawn for whatever reason? Give me some confidence.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, if there's one thing I'm struck by at our division, it is a really good rapport with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So that they engage with us well before we're down to the point where they're making a final approval or decision on a service. So that is something that we would be engaged with them to make sure we're fully covered. And all the time I've been with SDS, which has been for 3 years now, we've not had them change course that dramatically in any way.
Mr. Representative Ruppert.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Prox. So as I understand this, and I just want to make sure I'm clear on what the bill is doing. So you have a family who is providing foster care, and obviously there's other instances where this would this adult care home license would be used for elderly and such. But in the instance of a foster family, that child ages out. In this case, the parents then apply to have, or a parent in that case, potentially apply for their home to be licensed as a adult care home. And then they receive, in some cases, a financial, if it is reimbursement or a monthly stipend. Is that what that $408 is that's mentioned in the summary of House Bill 58? That says that there's a new option for a live-in adult care home, receive other waiver and Medicaid services. Daily cost is $408. Would that, so that's $408 a day going to the family of the adult foster child. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffers, thank you for the opportunity to explain what the summary is saying. This this new option, as described here in the summary, would be the cost to the state. This would be the cost to the state. So it would be inclusive of the daily rate that we're paying those former foster parents, now adult care home providers. It would include other services that the person would be eligible for. So that this summary was just meant to show compare how some of our service arrays, what some of our service arrays cost the state now, and how roughly, and this based on lots of potentially different scenarios, lots of different caveats, but just to give an idea as to how this, the cost for the service would fall compared to other services that are currently available.
And just a brief follow-up, if I may.
Uh-huh.
What is the daily rate that would be paid to an adult foster family?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffords, that's not been, that would be determined through the course of this, of the regulatory process. The Office of Rate Review at the department would help us determine what an appropriate rate would be. So it hasn't been set yet.
I believe Representative Mina.
Thank you, Chair, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I have just one other question related to the fiscal notes. And so from my understanding, for the fiscal note for residential licensing, the request is to have one new FTE and then upon year six, another FTE. And then looking at the fiscal, the second fiscal note for senior and disability services, it is just one FTE. And so do we anticipate that there might be a need if, you know, in one division, it sounds like there could be more providers applying after in a couple of years. So if there's an increase in providers, will we also need increased capacity to do inspections for more facilities?
Through the chair, Representative Mina, yes, the folks at the residential licensing section are more actively out in visiting facilities. They're visiting facilities, and in fact, they do some of the certification oversight that SDS needs. We have a great partnership with them where they are doing some of the oversight regarding our certified services. So our fiscal note is lower because we don't anticipate needing a second person in the out years.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And we are starting to run over time, but Representative Fields.
Thanks to the chair. Just following up on Representative Ruffridge's question about rates. I just hope that the department looks at rates in the context of my previous question about can we essentially allow outsourcing of care. And I hope that we're cognizant that the rates, should there be outsourcing of care allowed, that the rates would permit a wage that at a bare minimum meets state minimum wage requirements. There have been cases in federal service contracts where firms are winning service contracts where it's mathematically impossible to pay a minimum wage. So we as a government never want to put a provider in a position that they're essentially forced to pay sub-minimum wages in an area where accountability may be difficult. So I hope that we're just cognizant of that and craft the rates and any ability to outsource care accordingly. Thanks.
Okay. Is there any further comments?
None for me. Thank you again for the opportunity.
Any further questions? With that, we will set House Bill 58 aside. And are there any committee comments? comments or questions about the committee? With that, we will adjourn the House and Social Services Committee at 4:07.